This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on the recent victory at Standing Rock.
This is the kind of victory that makes movements grow and prosper. Let's get the details on how it unfolded.
Since the recent election, it seems that watch lists are becoming the new normal. Today we talk about the professor's watch list.
Not to be alarmist, but this is how it started in Germany. These people want to censor truth tellers, and we're here on our program to defend them.
Political poet Raymond Nat Turner joins us to share some poetry and also to talk about another watch list.
The other watch list is Proper Not, and Raymond, who's the poet in residence at the Black Agenda Report, finds himself on it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The Standing Rock Sioux Indian Tribe of North Dakota and their many allies won a tremendous victory on December 4th. They got the oil pipeline stopped, at least for now. It was being built by the Energy Transfer Partners through their sacred lands, without consultation, and in violation of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, and it was planned to be constructed under the Missouri River. A Department of the Army announcement stated that it would seek an alternative route for the 1,100-mile, $3.7 billion project. A break in the pipeline would have polluted the drinking water for up to 15 million people. What accounted for this historic victory? And what is the legal and financial status of the project? We'll get answers today from returning guest, National Lawyers Guild attorney Jeff Haas. He has been part of the legal team at Standing Rock from its inception. Jeff Haas, huge congratulations and welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, glad to be here.
Tell us, what was your reaction to the announcement last week by the Department of the Army that they were not letting the project go forward?
Well, it was first I was surprised, I must say, and I think that was a general sentiment. It did kind of surprise us. It had been what we were asking for, but nevertheless, it was a very pleasant surprise. It kind of was an endorsement of all the work that people have done, that public fighting, public opinion can be affected by people taking strong stands. And so it was an affirmation of the work that had been done and people's putting their lives on the line and putting themselves out there. So I think there was a jubilation that got recognized, that actually affected the government, and that we got a decision that acknowledged the righteousness of the claim that this pipeline was built without proper consultation with the tribes with regard to either their sacred sites or the environmental impact.
Jeff, let's talk about the forces that were involved. And it was a historic gathering of solidarity amongst the indigenous Native Americans. And moreover, they got all kinds of allies that came in. Talk to us about how this all unfolded.
Well, you started, of course, with the tribes themselves saying, wait a minute, you're trying to build this water, this oil pipeline, right through our sacred territory, right through land that we still claim we have the right to, that was given to us under treaty. And so they camped out near the path that the pipeline wanted to follow. But what followed was a tremendous amount of unity among the tribes themselves. All of the seven nations of the Sioux tribe came together here, and then they were joined by 200 to 300 other sovereign Indian nations who came in and supported them, from Alaska to Canada to South America, and just the showing here. And as you enter the camp, you just see all these flags representing all these Native nations. So the solidarity there was great. And then, of course, you had a large number of people who were committed to the environment, who, because of the fact that it brings Bakken oil, dirty Bakken oil from North Dakota, probably to the Gulf to be sent overseas, it's oil that should stay in the ground. It's oil that will add to the CO2 footprint. And then, of course, the fact that the path goes right under the Missouri River, and the reservoir from which the from which the sacred stone camp gets its water, the further threat. So the campaign was water is life, resonated with all kinds of groups around the country and around the world, since water, precious water, pure water, is very important. And if there was a spill under the Missouri River that leaked there, it could not only threaten the water supply of the Sioux Nation, but also millions of people downstream. So it was really joined by a lot of different forces. And then most recently, this weekend, thousands of veterans came up to join forces, because the Army Corps of Engineers had said the permit to camp there was going to end on Monday. And so thousands of people came up, veterans, unarmed, but willing to be human shields to defend the water protectors. So that was that show of unity, and the camp swelled to about 12,000 people this weekend. So in the face of this potential eviction, there was tremendous solidarity, and one must think that that also had an effect on getting this ruling denying the permit.
Jeff, how did the law enforcement agents on site respond when the veterans showed up?
Well, ever since they made their statement that they were going to, first the governor said he was going to withdraw services, and the Army Corps of Engineers said they were going to withdraw services, and then the tribes held fast, they started backing off of those comments, saying, well, it would be a humanitarian crisis if in the middle of blizzard we didn't provide emergency services. And so I think that, and the fact that they knew these veterans were coming, so they backed off a bit. And apparently they've backed off a little bit from this bridge, even though they haven't opened the bridge north of the camp. They're not stationed there at the moment, and there are negotiations going on to open up this bridge.
Jeff, can you talk about the class forces involved in pressuring the Obama administration on one side to stop this construction, and then on the other to allow it to go forward?
Yeah, the big banks, the big right. oil. I mean, what a confrontation.
Yeah, right? I think that's really a lot what it's about. You know, people from all classes who have a concern about future generations, about the need for clean water, about the need to reduce climate change, have all seen this as sort of a line in the sand, that this brings together all those struggles, plus the sovereignty of Native people and the sanctity of their sites, not to mention their rights to the land that was granted them. So you had a large number of people coming to support those various causes and the leadership of indigenous people in this. On the other side, you had a very avaricious company, Energy Transfer Partners, who were sort of under a deadline to get this pipeline done, because right now there's sort of an abundance of pipeline and a shortage of oil. The oil production in the Bakken fields has gone down as oil prices have gone down. So they made a contract with the shippers, the people who provide the oil. When oil prices were $100 a barrel, now they're 40 or 50. So they were trying to get it done before the shippers had an opportunity to get out, because the contract allowed them to get out, they say it does, in January. And the other thing was the banks had financed this and had put up a lot of money. So the longer the pipeline gets stalled, the riskier the investments of the banks, and also the more likelihood that the contracts won't be renewed. So there is a very strong time issue here. And so I think one of the ways people have and should continue to do is put pressures on the banks, in particular Wells Fargo, Bank of America. There are a number of banks that have loaned the money. And if they recall their loans, the whole project would fall through. So the pipeline is vulnerable. On the other hand, I don't want people to get too optimistic here. The pipeline is also, because there's a lawsuit in D.C. in which the court declared that the Corps of Engineers did do enough working with the tribes, that they did do enough consultation, that the permit that was granted and the form of study that was done, an environmental study, was sufficient. So they're back in court saying to that judge, and they want a hearing Friday or Monday, to say to the judge, this decision to deny the permit goes against what the Army Corps of Engineers had previously found. So that's one of the ways they're going to fight this, is try to get that judge to overturn this new denial of a permit. They're also, of course, sitting and waiting for Trump to take over, and who knows what he might try to do by executive order or through the Corps of Engineers to either set up a very limited re-examination or no re-examination at all. And I think that's caused, as a result, while there's a lot of excitement at camp about what was the victory, there's also some concern about what happens next. And the tribal chief, Dave Archibald, has said it's time to go home. We've accomplished what we said we would do. And there are a lot of other people who say, well, we're not, until this whole project is declared off, we're not leaving. So I'm not sure exactly how the percentages break down, but there's a lot of militancy. And, of course, the militancy is in the middle of this blizzard. So it's incredibly terrible, tough conditions with tops of tents flying off and tents being knocked over and it being very, very cold. What toll that's going to take, I guess, remains to be seen. But the majority, I sense, of the people who are there are at least not saying they're not ready to move yet.
Is the blizzard going on as we speak?
It is. It is. It started as a snow blizzard with 24 inches. Now we're talking about sub-zero weather and 20 to 40 mile an hour winds.
Oh.
I wonder, though, Jeff, if the majority of the people leave, might it not be more difficult to get back, at least if they have sort of a stronghold there? They can't
that's
be
true.
Prevented.
I mean, I think that's the sense. If people leave and go home, are they want to come back in these conditions? And so there's a question, well, is this, are we being faked out? I think at least short term, maybe until this decision happens in D.C., a lot of people aren't going to leave. And I'm not sure if people are going to wait and see how quickly Trump tries to push the pipeline. He has said publicly that he supports the pipeline. The former very pro-oil congressman from North Dakota is now he's going to be his new Department of Energy person. So he accepts the sort of view of petrol that North Dakota politicians put forward. So I think there's a loyalty to him and them, not to mention that he's invested, at least at one point, quite heavily in the $500,000 to $1 million in the pipeline or in the companies that are putting the pipeline together. He said he's no longer has those as large an investment. But then, of course, Trump doesn't feel there's any conflict between investing in something and making a decision that makes more money for him.
He's also for more coal, nuclear.
Yes.
He'll just take any restraints off these people that are warming up and ruining the planet. What is the legal team that you're on doing now?
Well, for one thing, we still have 450 criminal cases, so we're trying to cover those. We had a legal meeting of a lot of lawyers from around the country, from the Guild in particular, have come up here and offered their services. And what the bottleneck is that you can't practice in North Dakota, even pro hoc vice, without a local lawyer at your side. So we need to get, it's still difficult to have enough local lawyers who are willing to either try cases with us or be in court, so we can't just come in and try cases. So we had a meeting on Sunday night. We're trying to expand that. We're also trying to see how many of these cases are going to be joined, because they can't really handle 450 cases. Are they going to try 10 people at once? And if so, can we get one good defense lawyer from out of town working with local lawyers? Can some people represent themselves? So that's one issue that we're trying to confront. We filed a lawsuit against the kind of forces that were being used on November 20th when they used water cannons and rubber bullets and tear gas against people on the bridge who weren't a threat to the police. The police were some distance away, and they just let go with all this stuff that caused a lot of injuries. We just heard somebody still in the hospital with pneumonia. One woman, of course, has lost her arm. It has been put back on, but it's unclear how much usage she's going to get of it. Somebody else had a detached retina. So we did file a lawsuit here. We asked for an injunction. The judge denied that because we hadn't served the other side in 2 days, even though there was a blizzard and everything was closed. So now we're reopening that and hope to get a hearing on that soon. And then there's we're not doing it, but there's the continuation of the case in D.C. So there are a number of things. There's also a grand jury that we learned, a federal grand jury up here that's looking into possible criminal charges against water protectors for what happened on the bridge on November 20th. And I think they want to blame the water protectors for what happened to Sophia Walensky. Just learning about that.
She's the young woman that lost the use of her arm. Arm was
right.
Shattered. Just a horrible description by her father about what parts of her arm are now lost. She's had multiple surgeries.
I guess a message is it's not time to stop supporting the water protectors, and it's time to amplify the pressure on the oil companies and the banks. And if we can delay this long enough to make it unfeasible, and there are a lot of market forces that are making it unfeasible, then maybe we can defeat this pipeline. But it's not, I don't think anybody here thinks it's over. It's going to continue. It is a tremendous victory, but we have to keep pushing.
Jeff Haas, it's always been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us once again. We've gotten used to having you on every week. Hopefully it won't be quite as often, but if we need you, we'll call.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here, and I really appreciate that you're putting out this important message to your listeners.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks,
Haas.
Jeff. In the weeks after the presidential election, we've heard rumblings in the news about a variety of watch lists. Recently, a student organization called Turning Point launched a website called the Professor Watch List. It publishes the names, locations, and alleged offenses of liberal academics with the mission to, quote, expose and document college professors who discriminate against conservative students, promote anti-American values, and advance leftist propaganda in the classroom. Offenses, as they're called, may include using swear words or asserting that racism exists in this country. Members of the public are invited to submit tips. Joining us to talk about the Professor Watch List is Rebecca Schumann, a columnist for Slate and author of Schadenfreude, A Love Story. Her recent article in Slate, Oh Good, A Professor Watch List, outlines a number of concerns about this development. Rebecca Schumann, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Rebecca, tell us about Turning Point USA. When was it founded and who runs it?
It was founded in 2012, and it's co-run by a sort of behind-the-scenes older Republican activist, and the face of it is a young man named Charlie Kirk, who I talked to for this article. He was only 18 when he co-founded the organization, and he actually has never been to college. Turning Point is a conservative organization that focuses on economic issues. So they're really into free market principles and bootstraps, et cetera. And Charlie really believes very strongly that there is a strong, not just a liberal bias in academe, but a force to indoctrinate students. Granted, he's never been to college, so I'm not sure. I think he would probably be either pleasantly surprised or disappointed, depending on how ideological he is, to find what college classes are actually like. But I spoke to him, and he assured me that this organization is in no way affiliated with the alt-right, white nationalism, any of the other sort of unsavory, disturbing organizations that have come out of the woodwork since Donald Trump ran for president and won. He assures me that he and all the people in his organization denounce those people in completely.
And yet the timing of the launching of the website, you note, was not too long after a group of neo-Nazis took to the streets praising Trump.
Yes, it was 2 days. And so Mr. Kirk, who's now 23, he assured me that this was coincidental and they had been planning that launch for months. But if you look at his Twitter feed and all the other media around Turning Point, they definitely took advantage of the heightened notoriety that the list got. Because when it came out, it was sort of the same day all these articles were coming out in the New York Times and the Washington Post about this neo-Nazi convention in Washington, and people were worried. They were sort of watching this video of that, I guess I won't call him a young man, he's my age, of Richard Spencer, you know, calling the journalist, the Lügenpresse, a German word that dates back to the Nazi era, and just, you know, saying hi to Trump. So people were already very uneasy about lists, you know, registration lists, watch lists, all this talk of Muslim registration, of you know, forced deportation of individuals in this country. The timing was not good. And, you know, he told me that any sort of attempt to threaten or intimidate professors based on this list was preposterous. He used that word. But the people who appreciated the list, the people that I heard from, some of the names I was called, there's definitely a Venn diagram overlap with the folks who were shouting Heil Trump.
Now, let's talk about the list. It's a list of professors that I guess are accused of infractions such as
promoting anti-American values, advancing leftist propaganda.
Right. And some of them have photographs, correct?
Anyone who has a photograph on their department website, Turning Point lifted that photograph and put it on their website.
And is there commentary by students? Who posts these names to the list, as far as you know?
The list is right now, it's an aggregate of other lists, such as the ones from Campus Reform, et cetera, or about professors that make headlines, usually in the conservative media, for running afoul of their conservative students. People can submit. They can submit a tip, but Mr. Kirk assured me that they didn't just put anybody up there. Once a tip was submitted, they had to source it. Unfortunately, the sourcing can be a little wonky. Some of the individuals that I looked at on there, including several law professors, one from Harvard. So there's a gentleman who is a law professor at Harvard who is accused of saying that people should treat right-wingers like Nazis. And that's how he advances un-American values or anti-conservative bias. But I looked at the blog post that was referred to, and that's not what he actually says at all. In context, he's talking about how people should treat folks on the losing side of the culture wars. And he said, you know, it's somewhat provocative language, and he said, well, you know, how did we treat the Germans and Japanese after they lost World War II? We weren't always trying to appease them all the time. So it was definitely edgy language, but as you can imagine, it's a bit of a stretch to say, you know, therefore all right-wingers are Nazis.
Rebecca, have you spoken to any of the professors who were listed to get their reactions?
I did speak to one over email, and she was, it's funny because all of the right-wingers who emailed me, like David Horowitz, actually he tweeted me, were just thought my piece was just left-wing garbage. They keep calling me a leftist, which is very funny. I don't identify that way. And then a lot of the people who were on the list emailed me, and they thought I had been too balanced, too conciliatory. And so they objected to the reputability of the sources. Of the way that the site had sourced their infractions. They thought that that came from generally places like the Daily Caller or other conservative outlets that specialize in taking people out of context, including me.
Rebecca Schumann, you wrote in your Slate article that, quote, the list watches over us at a dark turning point, poised to inflame the tinder-dry, gasoline-soaked pitchforks of a mob just stepping into the light. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the white supremacist folks and the other nationalist nativist folks who've kind of lurked in the corners of the internet have always been here. They've always been here in America, but they have been made to think that their opinions are socially unacceptable, and rightly so. They are socially unacceptable, and that's something that we should always be reminding ourselves during the next 4 years all the time. These are folks that embraced Trump's candidacy. These are folks, to a certain extent, whom Trump embraced during his candidacy, retweeting them, refusing to disavow them, really only half-heartedly disavowing them after his election, and even then not all the way. So he was sort of too busy, angry at the cast of Hamilton to disavow the white supremacist screeching Hail Trump two blocks away from his new home. And so these are folks that have been emboldened, and they are really coming into the light at a moment when passions are high and nativist resentment has been stoked in this country and to a pretty good extent around the world. You see what's happening in Europe, et cetera.
Rebecca, what do you see as the potential damage of such a website?
Well, it gives you the pictures, the locations, and a very out-of-context sort of ire-stoking version of the quote-unquote danger of these folks. And, you know, you see over the weekend a gentleman who had nothing more than a bunch of whacked-out conspiracy theories about a so-called pedophilia ring in Washington, D.C., at a pizza parlor, and he showed up at that pizza parlor where there were children, with children not being, you know, smuggled, just children enjoying pizza with their parents, and he fired a shot. Luckily, no one was hurt. But to me, if you stoke the ire of a bunch of folks who are already really inflamed about, you know, nationalist, nativist issues, and then you give them photos and locations of people, to me, I found that, and to everybody I talked to, I found that absolutely chilling. And I'm not going to even go into concretely what the possibilities of that are because I don't want to give anybody any ideas. But I think that they speak for themselves.
What do you think might an effective answer be to this kind of site? How do we respond to what seems to be a proliferation of hate sites and lists?
Well, I really am proud of all of the professors who have done their best to brush this off and say, look, I think it's a patch of, you know, it's a badge of honor to be not liked by David Horowitz. I consider it a good thing when that's the case. And many of them have gone into more detail about their pedagogy and about the things that they teach and have provided context. Now, that's putting the onus on the victim to explain themselves. And I don't necessarily think that's fair. I think that you'll see the next 4 years different free speech advocacy organizations such as the Nonpartisan Fire, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, right, which has both run afoul of the left and the right. People on the left and right are not friends of Fire. They always answer my phone calls as a journalist, so I'm a fan. But you'll see folks like that and the Southern Poverty Law Center and some other partisan places as well, probably coming up with counter, I would guess, that their social media teams will come up with counter sites that provide more context. But the alarming thing about this is that other than placing the onus completely on the victims of this to justify their existence, there isn't really that much that you can do because the internet is the internet. It's uncontrollable.
Have you received... you referenced this earlier, much hate mail in response to your piece?
Definitely a good smattering. I have been called words I cannot repeat on the radio. I was also excerpted in the Daily Caller out of context, which brought me a new set of angry. So David Horowitz had a mention in this article, and I think he has a news alert on his name, so he was really angry about it. All his fans came after me, and then all the Daily Caller folks came after me too, and this one gentleman made a YouTube video basically crowing about how you know, the social justice warrior movement is dying and quote unquote leftists like me are having a complete aneurysm over it, and he read some paragraphs from my article in a mocking voice and you know, took them out of context and is sort of enjoying basically putting me on blast on YouTube and inviting all of his white supremacist friends to come after me. But it's nothing I haven't had happen to me before. When you write for Slate, this is sort of what happens to you every day.
It is very scary because we all know the history of what happened in Germany in the 30s when leftist professors were kicked out of colleges, along with Jewish professors. And these evocations of the Japanese internment camps and the Muslim registry. And this is before Trump has even taken office, and these people have been emboldened. So we very much appreciate your efforts here, Rebecca. And I think when we get this out in the air, that's the way we're going to fight back.
Sure hope so.
We just have a few minutes remaining. Are there any issues that we didn't cover that you would like to talk about?
Well, the one thing that I think is important to say is that the way that democracy can fight for itself and the shadow of authoritarianism is through knowledge. The truth will set you free. And so the work that all professors are doing on all sides of the ideological spectrum, when they're actually in their classrooms, in their own context, doing their thing, very little of which is quote-unquote indoctrination when you actually look at it in context. Usually what these folks are doing is elucidating the opinion of somebody who has written something. They're not actually foisting that opinion themselves onto their students. And parsing through difficult texts, whether you agree with them or not, parsing through difficult opinions, whether you agree with them or not, and thinking as hard as you can and as critically as you can about the world around you, that's how we're going to get through this. And so the work that these all professors are doing right now is more crucially important than ever. And so I just hope that everybody stays strong, no harm comes to anybody, and that folks who enjoy making watch lists like this themselves maybe do a little reading in their own history and in the history of the world and think about the consequences of their actions.
What you just said reminded me of something that the great Columbia professor, sociologist C. Wright Mills used to say. He said, "I try to be objective. I don't claim to be detached." And that should be our watchword.
Rebecca, it's been so nice to get to know you for a bit, and we hope to have you on again. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today, we welcome back to Law and Disorder the political poet Raymond Nat Turner. Turner is the poet in residence at the internet site and radio show Black Agenda Report. He and others have come under attack by an outfit called Proper Not, a shabby group which has created a blacklist that includes over 200 outlets from the right-wing Drudge Report and Russian government-funded Russia Today to WikiLeaks and an array of marginal conspiracy and far-right sites. The blacklist also includes some of the flagship publications of the progressive left, including Truthdig, Counterpunch, Truthout, Naked Capitalism, and, of course, the Black Agenda Report, which is a leftist African-American opinion hub that is critical of the liberal black political establishment. While denying McCarthyite intentions, the group is openly attempting to compel, quote, formal investigations by the U.S. government because the kind of folks who make propaganda for brutal authoritarian oligarchies are often involved in a wide range of bad business, end quote. The group also seeks to brand major progressive politics. The group also seeks to brand major political progressive political sites and a number of prominent right-wing opinion outlets as, quote, gray fake media propaganda outlets, end quote, which are influenced or directly operated by Russia's federal security services. It can then compel Facebook and Google to ban them, denying them the ad revenue they rely on to survive.
Raymond Nat Turner, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Again. Real nice to see you, Raymond. We're going to ask you if you'd be kind enough to share with our audience a couple of your poems. But before we do that, there's a real scary development out there. It's called Proper Not. You've written about that. You may be affected by it. What is Proper Not?
Well, what it claims to be is an independent group of researchers, former intelligence operatives, and activists, believe it or not, and they're intent on sorting out, rooting out propagandists for basically for the Kremlin. Let's just cut to the chase, you know, and it's seems to be completely bogus to me because they don't list their sources of funding. They're not transparent about their membership, nor would they meet with any credible press people, you know, in person.
And do they publish a blog of outlets that they claim are, what, un-American?
Yes, yeah. They have a list of 200 blogs and sites, including Truth Dig, Truth Out, Naked Capitalism,
Counterpunch,
and of course Black Agenda Report, which I'm poet in residence at.
And tell us a little bit more about Black Agenda Report and why, in your opinion, was it targeted?
Well, I have my theories and my ideas. They're not, I don't think they're especially well formulated at this juncture. But first and foremost, you know, Black Agenda Report is noted for its opposition to what I call the black bourgeoisie, and they call at Black Agenda Report the black misleadership class, which we have a slight disagreement in that I think they're leading fine for their own class interests because their class interests are about contracts, subcontracts, board positions at various corporations and so forth. And I think they've been doing a wonderful job at that. And at the same time, their class leadership is predicated on stopping, if you will, you know, the upsurge of the African-American movement as evidenced in Ferguson and Baltimore.
The grassroots, in other words.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what you think earned the Black Agenda Report a place on the proper not list.
Absolutely. And then I think also Black Agenda Report, and I know especially myself, you know, my focus is so much about war preparations, opposition to war, because it's kind of the centerpiece, you know, if you look at all you look at a pie chart of the U.S. budget and 60% goes to war and to the war profiteers.
Raymond, you've written that the Washington Post gave this proper not outfit a huge friendly shout out. What's the role the Washington Post has played in all of this?
Well, to my knowledge, basically, they gave them a pass. Like, they approached a number of journalists, and most rejected their ploy, you know, and without any kind of transparency. You know, who are you? Where's your funding coming from? Who's on your board and so forth? And they none of this stuff was available to journalists, and so they rejected it. And so it seems to me that a news organization as old as the Washington Post would do a much better job in vetting something like that if they chose to do so.
I wonder if Law and Disorder might qualify to be on this list. I would consider it a badge of honor to be in your company.
Oh, you will. No doubt.
Raymond, what can people do about this threat?
Well, one of the things, I'm a steering committee member at the National Writers Union, and one of the things we have been doing is posting the articles from Alternet and other articles that are exposing this. And we're also wanting to start an online petition that people can sign. And I think one of the key things, because this is not new, and actually it's worldwide, because NWU has been hosting a series of events dealing with and supporting writers who are being oppressed, like, say, in Turkey, also in Iran. We just Sunday, we hosted an Iranian poet, and she was arrested and tortured, and then she's in exile in Greece now. And so this is worldwide. this country certainly has a long history, a long sordid history of this kind of activity, because they at one point had a publication called Red Channels. And if an artist signed a petition or went to a march or a meeting, they ended up on Red Channels, and then subsequently work was started to disappear from them, and it created a lot of havoc. A lot of artists' careers were ruined and so forth, and people committed suicide and these kinds of things. And so it's certainly not unprecedented.
No, we're talking about another appearance of a McCarthy period, really.
Absolutely.
The new COINTELPRO, as it were.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, Raymond, we were hoping to hear from you with a couple of your poems, if you would.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, this is the reason you made the list,
a treat,
Raymond.
Right.
Please share it with us. What would you like to read?
One thing I before I read what I would like to read, I'd like to commend Law and Disorder, and I think I said this before in my previous visit with you, that Law and Disorder is indeed one of my favorite programs, and I say that, you know, I'm not blowing smoke.
Thank you.
You know, it's like, and so one feature I particularly like is that you're in touch with Flynn Taylor and Chicago People's Law, and finding out, because Chicago is one of the hot points in the country. And the other thing is that since Standing Rock has been going on, you all have been in touch with the Red Owl Collective and National Lawyers Guild folks and so forth. And so that's been a really outstanding service that you've been providing. So thank you so much for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That means a lot to us.
So this piece is called Red Alert. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. A love supreme, a love supreme. For Mother Earth and her creatures, her gifts. A love supreme, a love supreme. Dangerous dance, lethal songs, powerful prayers from the four directions. First Nations, spirit weapons of mass instruction. Amassing the world's hearts and minds on the cannonball. A love supreme, a love supreme. For Mother Earth and her creatures, her gifts. Water is life. Capitalism is death. Profaning, poisoning, weaponizing water. Greasy Gulf water wiping mussel, crab, shrimp out. Brownish flint water, bearing brain-damaged babies. Black Pennsylvania prison water causing cancer and young inmates' hair to fall out. Calling all R2P people, come in R2P people. Calling all sanctions people, come in sanctions people. Calling all no-fly zone people, come in no-fly zone people. Calling all blockade people, come in blockade people. Where's the hue and cry? He's using chemical weapons, gassing, torturing his own people, cracking down on dissent. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Where's the tom-tom pulsing regime change, regime change, regime change, regime change? Calling all people's climate marchers, all 300,000 of you. Come in, people's climate marchers. Maybe you're busy since Matthew hit Haiti, killing over 1,000. Calling all people's climate marchers, all 300,000 of you, come in, people's climate marchers. Your Cochabamba moment flares up like Ken Sarawiwa's spirit in Ogoni water warriors. In water protectors fighting Flint terror on the Missouri, protecting our lifeblood 7 generations deep. Needing a surge, boots on the ground, money for fighting absurd arrest, medical supplies for tending class war wounds. Fluent in forked tongue, the drone ranger declared November, Native American month, morphing into cross-dressing Klansmen, reenacting high-tech attacks, taking down Occupy. Calling all climate marchers, all 300,000 of you, come in, people's climate marchers. Come make me eat crow. Make me a liar. Make me apologize for saying you were white folks first, lovers of land, peoples, creatures last, for saying the prison industrial complex was cool with you. If only inmates wore recycled rubber sneakers, orange jumpsuits of organic cotton, beatings with bamboo batons only. Make me apologize for saying you were okay with empire if electric Humvees and tanks and solar-powered aircraft carriers were deployed. Calling all people's climate marchers, all 300,000 of you, come in, people's climate marchers. Forgive me, for a few of you have gone from the four directions, smuggling Sitting Bull spirit salve, love bomb in eyes of Ida, hearts of Harriet, spines of John Brown, tongues of Douglas, metal detectors, strip searches rarely detect.
That was beautiful. Really powerful. Thank you.
As
Raymond.
Usual.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I heard Coltrane play Love Supreme.
You heard it?
Back in the day. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where was that?
I was at the auditorium at the University of Wisconsin
in
1965. Raymond, one of the poems that you've written recently, which I thought was extraordinarily powerful, is a short poem called Do the Math.
Oh.
Did you bring that?
Yeah, I brought that.
Would you share that with us, please?
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to me because math is not my strong suit, but I get this math. Do the math. Word problem. You're the 1%. Your yacht, jet, multiple residences, endless wars, poison water, champagne caviar lifestyles, Cayman Island crowdsourcing. Your life means minds of the 99% must be silly putty, Play-Doh, in your hands. Which math must you use? A, addition. B, multiplication. C, subtraction. Or D, division.
Raymond, it would be a treasure for us if you could read one more of your poems.
Okay, it'd be great for me. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's our honor.
This is called, you know the title. I mean, you're familiar. Make America Great Again. 44, 45. Is Sonny succeeding Michael? Gangsters still in power. Their state muscle for fossil fuel families, war profiteer families, big farmer protection bankster families, family values, iron fists beneath velvet glove, carrot and stick, Mike and Ike, good cop, bad cop, force and deception, sweet nothing promises wafting with water cannon, pepper spray, tear gas, rubber bullet, Bill of Rights, snarling dog investigations, hearing what's been heard 10,000 times. 2 years of absurdist theater spasms temporarily halted. Curtain call. The commander bows, solemn. We're all on the same team. Gold-plated Iron Lady, resign. Have an open mind. Give him a chance to lead. Sheepdoggy dog co-signing. He's a man who can be worked with. Smoking gun, mushroom cloud, puffed up Pillsbury doughboy, Trumpolini, rises on hot air. Unstable, unpredictable, destructive like capitalism, to make America great again. I say, go ahead, make my day, make America great again. when Underground Railroad excursions cost splintered families escaping auction-blocked aspirations, when rebellions, raids, war temporarily overthrew torture, murder, mutilation, rape, liberating labor in all hues. When Indian killer Custer met tough love, Lakota and Northern Cheyenne, Arapaho style, at the Battle of the Greasy Grass, I say, go ahead, make my day, make America great again. When streets were class struggle universities, and communists, socialists, anarchists, labor leaders, their professors. When Flint struck 1,000 points of light, 40-day, 40-night sit-down strike. When self-help movements, sharecropper unions, worker alliance groups, unemployed councils metastasized through 30s veins. Organizing unemployed tenants, farmers, feeding hungry, clothing naked, putting the evicted back in their homes. When longshore workers shut down, tied up 2,000 miles of Pacific coast. When San Francisco, Minnesota, general strike concessions trickled down like magic bullets. I say, go ahead, make my day, make America great again. When African Americans walked, carpooled, boycotting Montgomery's apartheid buses 381 days. When students rode buses from up south, down south, through savage southern gauntlets. Sat in at lynch mob lunch counters. Brave murderous heathens registering elders to vote. When students shut down San Francisco State for 4 months. Birthing black student unions, black studies programs, when Chinese and Vietnamese issued statements supporting struggles of African American warriors, when Brown Berets, Young Lords, Ames, SDS, NOW, and anti-war activists were born. I say, go ahead, make my day, make America great again. An embryonic world's revealing itself, pregnant with new powers, protecting water, fighting for 15, occupying Wall Street, making Black Lives Matter. We're at home with it. We can live with it. You, on the other hand, are unwelcome, not needed, fired. So, Mr. Mother, I say, go ahead, make my day, make America great again.
Thank you, Raymond.
Raymond, thank you so much.
Yeah, that's the reason that this outfit, Proper Not, wants to censor this wonderful political poet, this truth teller. We're going to do what we can to get in their way.
Thank you very much. Yes, thanks. It's just really a great moment in history, I think, when so many of the forces are aligned, you know, just like at other periods in time when these offensives have been launched and we've not had our forces in place. But, you know, there's just been so much going on over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, as evidenced in Occupy, the occupation of Wisconsin's capital and Black Lives Matter, et cetera, et cetera. So, Thank you.
We're poised to rise to the occasion.
That's it.
Thank you.
Raymond Nat Turner, it's been great to have you on Law and Disorder.
Bye-bye.
All right.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.